Oh, sorry. Okay, better? So I would like to talk about algebraic quantum gravity, but first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for organizing the conference and letting me speak in this session. So the plan of my talk will be as follows. First, I would like to motivate why it's interesting at all to introduce a more algebraic approach to a theory of quantum gravity. And the motivation basically comes from the status of the dynamics in loop quantum gravity, and in particular from the semi-classical limit of loop quantum gravity. Then I would like to say a few words about the master constraint program, which was already introduced by Thomas this morning, but which plays a major role in the algebraic approach to quantum gravity. Afterwards, I will explain the conceptual setup of algebraic quantum gravity, its kinematics and dynamics, and at the end discuss its semi-classical limit. And finally, I will give a conclusion and outlook. So let me start my motivation with the basics of loop quantum gravity. So the classical starting point is the canonical formulation of general relativity, as was mentioned by Thomas already this morning. And the elementary variables we use are holonomies and fluxes. And as we have heard already this morning, holonomies are basically connections integrated along one-dimensional edges, and the fluxes are two surface integrals over the conjugated electric field. So additionally to a Poisson algebra of these holonomies and fluxes, we get so-called constraints. And in the case of GR, this is the Gauss diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraints, which are just phase-based functions that are supposed to vanish. One can then take this classical framework and quantize it, and what one gets is the kinematical Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity, on which these constraint functions can be implemented as operators. And as we have already heard this morning, bases of the Hilbert space are so-called spin network functions, which live on certain graphs, and graphs are just union of single edges which meet in vertices, and we associate to each of these edges an SU2 spin quantum number, which is indicated by the coloring here in this picture. So on that Hilbert space, we can then indeed write something down like the quantum Einstein equations, which basically state that the states we are looking for, so-called physical states, are those which are annihilated by all the constraint operators. And this is somehow the starting point of our quantum theory. So a straightforward way to work with this theory is just find solutions of the quantum Einstein equations, find suitable experiments, and then falsify or verify these equations. And in particular, it would be important to, in some sense, rediscover the classical solutions of general relativity. However, these equations are very complicated, at least as complicated as the classical Einstein equation, so it's not so straightforward to find a general solution of these equations. So it could be a good idea to go one step backwards and first check whether the starting point of the quantum theory you are working with is really correct. And another way to address this question is to ask, are these constraints operator correctly quantized? And if you want to do a semi-classical analysis of your constraint operators, it turns out that the most difficult part is the Hamiltonian constraint operator. And why this is the case, I want to explain on the following slide. So we heard already this morning that there exists a uniqueness result, the so-called loss theory, which states, roughly speaking, if you require background independence and you want to start with the holonomy flux algebra, the kinematical Hilbert space we use in loop quantum gravity is basically the only choice you have. And in this representation, we can define a unitary operator for finite diffeomorphisms, but it turns out that this operator is not weakly continuous, which means we can quantize exponentials of infinitesimal diffeomorphisms, but what we cannot do is to define the infinitesimal generator as an operator on the kinematical Hilbert space. And this is a problem in the sense if we look at the Hamiltonian constraint and we consider the constraint algebra, and in particular the Poisson bracket of two Hamiltonian constraints, where these n here are just smearing functions, we see that it's proportional to an infinitesimal diffeomorphism. So if we promote this relation to the quantum theory, we would get a commutator here on the left-hand side, but on the right-hand side, we should get something like an infinitesimal diffeomorphism operator, which does not exist. Therefore, you automatically would run into anomalies when you quantize the Hamiltonian constraint operator. However, there is a way to quantize the Hamiltonian constraint operator without anomalies, which was introduced by Thomas in 1996. And the philosophy he used was, if he requires that the commutator of two Hamiltonian constraints annihilates diffeomorphism in variant states. And this would be exactly the action an infinitesimal diffeomorphism operator had on those states. But if you use this condition, then it turns out that the Hamiltonian operator has to be quantized in a graph-changing way. And graph-changing means, suppose we have a very simple graph here consisting of five edges, and we let the Hamiltonian constraint operator act on these vertex V, then the action is basically that it adds an additional loop to the graph. And this loop goes also along a new edge. So after the action of the Hamiltonian, the graph has changed because the graph contains now also this additional edge. And it's exactly this point that the Hamiltonian operator is graph changing, which makes it very complicated when you want to try to analyze it semi-classically, as I will explain a bit more in detail later on. So an idea was also mentioned by Thomas this morning to overcome some of these problems is the so-called master constraint program. And there you take, instead of the single Gauss diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraint, you just you define a new constraint, which is basically the weighted sum of the squares of the single constraint. And you choose the weighting such that the total expression for the master constraint is basically diffeomorphism invariant. And then classically, it's very easy to show that the vanishing of M is completely equivalent to the vanishing of the three single constraints. A side effect is that due to the weighting and taking the squares of the constraint, you can really quantize these infinitesimal diffeomorphism operators, which is not possible if you just consider the single D. And since we are dealing with one constraint only, now the algebra trivializes. And if we promote this to the quantum theory, of course, the operator should also commute with itself. But at this point, it seems that all the anomalies which occur due to the Dirac algebra are gone, but these anomalies could reoccur in the sense that if one of the ingredients which enter the master constraint operator, and here I displayed only the Hamiltonian part due to limited space on my transparency, they could reoccur in the sense that if you analyze the spectrum of the master constraint, it could be the case that zero is not contained in the spectrum. And how to deal with such a situation, I will comment on in my conclusions. But the advantage of using the master constraint operator is that you can quantize it in two different ways. One would be graph changing, similar to the Hamiltonian, but this is for two reasons problematic. One reason is that it's for the same reason problematic as the Hamiltonian. It's the graph-changing operator, which is semi-classical problematic. The second reason is that since this operator is spatially diffeomorphism invariant, it has to be defined directly on the diffeomorphism invariant Hilbert space. And so far, no diffeomorphism invariant coherent or semi-classical states exist, so you cannot do an analysis on that Hilbert space. There's work in progress by Benjamin Barr on diffeomorphism invariant coherent states. The second possibility would be to quantize it in a graph-preserving way, because the algebra is trivial, and this can then be indeed defined on the kinematical Hilbert space for which semi-classical techniques exist. So let me again compare the difference between graph-changing and graph-preserving. So a graph-changing master constraint operator would, roughly speaking, do the same as the Hamiltonian. It would add an additional loop close to the vertex V that it is acting on, and the graph-preserving version of M would also add a loop to the graph, but these loops goes only along already existing edges. So what does change when the master constraint acts are the spin quantum numbers, but the number of edges stays the same. So if one wants to do a semi-classical analysis of the dynamical operators, what one needs is some semi-classical techniques. And what we basically want is a certain sector of our kinematical Hilbert space with an almost classical behavior. And that such so-called coherent states exist was shown by Winkler and Thiemann some years ago. And one of the properties of these states, which was already mentioned by Thomas, is that they approximate our basic operators, the holonomy and the flux operator, classically very well. and there will be more properties of coherent states in Benjamin's talk after mine. And this picture was also shown this morning, so you could think of a coherent state as a Gaussian state which is peaked and concentrated around a classical phase point given by an holonomy and a flux. And the aim is now, we have some quantum Einstein equations, we have some dynamical operators, and we would like to investigate their semi-classical limits. And I said, if we use the Hamiltonian, it's problematic because it's graph changing. And the reason why this is problematic is because if you consider two states defined on different graphs, they are orthogonal. So if I have an operator which is sandwiched between coherent states which are defined on a fixed graph, and the operator acts on these coherent states, the expectation value will be trivially zero. So what you would need to consider is the sum of all possible graphs, but this is impossible since the kinematical Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity is non-separable. So the second idea you could have is, okay, let's take advantage of the fact that the master constraint is graph preserving. Then you don't run into the similar problems as for the Hamiltonian. But if you want to consider all degrees of freedom of loop quantum gravity, you would need to consider all graphs that can be embedded in a given spatial manifold. Therefore, you would need to define the graph-preserving master constraint for each single graph, and then calculate for each single graph the semi-classical limit, which is impossible since we have to consider all graphs. So any semi-classical analysis you will make within the framework of loop quantum gravity will be extremely graph-dependent. And these are exactly the problems and motivations why it might be interesting to define a more algebraic approach to a theory of quantum gravity. So instead of using the framework of loop quantum gravity where we need all finite and embedded graphs, one can take advantage of the fact that the master constraint can be quantized graph preserving and try to formulate an embedding independent theory of quantum gravity, which I will call algebraic quantum gravity. So instead of using embedded graphs, we try to define a theory which is based on one fundamental infinite algebraic graph. And an algebraic graph, here I drew one of a cubic topology, is basically a set of points, which we would call vertices, and the information how many arrows or edges are pointing from one point to the other. And it does not know how these edges are embedded in a manifold, and it does not know how these edges are breaded. So the difference to the graphs used in loop quantum gravity is that the information about the topology and the differential structure of the underlying manifold is absent on the algebraic level. And the idea is then to define an analog of the holonomy flux algebra on this algebraic level, and also define your dynamical operators on the algebraic level. And the consequence is that you don't have any graph dependence anymore, because the chosen algebraic graph is fundamental. And this can indeed be done. So instead of using the embedded algebra of holonomy and fluxes, you use an abstract algebra, which is a Poisson algebra among just SU2 group elements and the conjugated electric fields, which take values in the Lie algebra of SU2. And then you quantize in the analog way of the techniques you use in loop quantum gravity, and you also get the kinematical Hilbert space. This is no longer the one we use in loop quantum gravity. It's von Neumann's infinite tensor product Hilbert space. But the advantage is that all physical operators, which are by definition gauge invariant, and therefore do not depend on the embedding, can be lifted very easily to the algebraic framework. And the dynamics in this framework is then described by the graph-preserving algebraic master constraint. So the quantum Einstein equations in this case just look like m psi phys equal to zero. So here we have another starting point for a different version of a theory of quantum gravity. And the first thing we would like to do now is to define semi-classical techniques in order to check whether this master constraint is quantized correctly. And in order to define algebraic coherent states, we need some data, and this data is a three-manifold sigma and a classical phase space point A and E. And we need an embedding of the algebraic graph into this spatial manifold. And with this data, one can then, in an analogous way, construct so-called algebraic coherent states. So therefore, you can say that the idea of algebraic quantum gravity is that the topology and the differential structure of sigma, as well as the background metric you want to approximate, is encoded in semi-classical states. So the picture you could have in mind is that we are working on this algebraic level here, and we define our algebra on this level and quantize the algebra on this level, and also define the master constraint on this level. And then the quantum dynamics is basically that the spin quantum numbers of these algebraic infinite graph are changing. So you don't know anything about a manifold, a differential structure, or a topology of this manifold. But whenever you go to the semi-classical sector of the theory, you have some information how this algebraic graph is embedded into a certain manifold. And this can, of course, be done in different ways. So setting up this framework of algebraic quantum gravity, we wanted to use these algebraic coherent states in order to analyze the semi-classical limit of M. And we used an algebraic cubic graph for our calculation. And if you sandwich the master constraint between these coherent states, what basically happens is the expectation value will be an expansion with respect to h-bar. And the leading order, which corresponds to the part where you send h-bar to zero, should basically reproduce the classical master constraint. And then we would say, okay, this operator is quantized correctly. And if we look at the leading order of our result, which is h-bar ascending to zero, we end up with a master constraint discretized on a cubic lattice. And this is exactly what we expected, because we did the calculation for an algebraic cubic graph. And as we heard already this morning, we are working in a background-independent theory, so we can also send the lattice regulator to zero without running into ultraviolet problems. And if we do this, we really rediscover the classical continuum master constraint. And this epsilon can also be seen as a fineness, as a measure of fineness of the embedding we choose. And therefore, one can say that in the leading order, the correct infinitesimal generators of GR are reproduced, because one can show that classically the master constraint is completely equivalent to the Gauss diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraint. Then we checked what happens in the next two leading order, which correspond to the quantum fluctuation of this operator, and we could show that they are finite and small compared to the leading order. So, summarizing, this means that we have a positive result for the algebraic master constraint operator with respect to the infinitesimal classical limit. So let me finally conclude. Algebraic quantum gravity provides a framework in which the dynamical operators can be analyzed semi-classically, and we could show that the master constraint reproduces the correct infinitesimal generators of general relativity in leading order, and that its quantum fluctuations are finite. And of course, there are lots of open questions and issues that have to be discussed and clarified. And one problem I've already mentioned, it could be that the kernel of the master constraint is empty, meaning that zero is not in the spectrum of the master constraint. So we would get anomalies also in this framework. And one proposal how to deal with this, which was already introduced by Dietrich and Thiemann, is that if you calculate the spectrum of the master constraint operator, and it turns out that the spectrum has a minimal value, which is of order h-bar, at least of order h-bar, then you could define a new master constraint operator, which is the old one minus this value, and then you could ensure that the new master constraint operator has zero in the spectrum. However, if we run into anomalies, this basically means we haven't not respected the Dirac algebra of constraints. So another idea would be to look into lattice gauge theory, where there are many similar problems occur if you want to put chiral fermions on the lattice. So there you there turns out that you have to define a lattice analog of a chiral transformation, and in particular, you cannot use the naive discretization of the Dirac operator. And if we look how our master constraint is quantized, it's basically the analog of a naive discretization. So there might be some hope that if you improve the discretization, that you can cure anomalies. Another point I mentioned is that in this framework we can quantize infinitesimal quantum diffeomorphisms. So there's not much known about these operators, so it would be very nice to analyze them more in detail. And a physical application, which is work in progress with Oliver Winkler, Stefan Hofmann, and Thomas Thiemann, is that you use the relational formalism and the physical Hamiltonian, which was mentioned by Thomas this morning, and then quantize the classical theory in the framework of algebraic quantum gravity and see what the algebraic quantum gravity has to tell about quantum cosmological perturbations. And finally, since this theory is formulated very much close to the language you use in ordinary lattice gauge theory, so if you want to do more numerical analysis of the master constraint operator, it might be very useful to look in that field and adopt some techniques from them. That's all. Thank you.
This is a very interesting development. I have two questions that worry me, so that that's how crazy it is. You can, you can set up a framework for any chosen common field graph, and then add preserves that graph, which is very generous in the monographic example. So therefore, for every chosen graph, there's a conservation law, which preserves that graph in the NMS. And so the theory has implicit in it an infinite number of quantum conservation laws, which preserve the graph from the start of which, but in general relativity, there's no analogous conservation laws. So how can you possibly get a constant in kind of general relativity? You have a large number, an infinite number of conservation laws, which are not part of constant general relativity.
Okay, let me ask back first. Why would you say it's a conservation law if I preserve the graph?
Because you set up the dynamics, you restrict the dynamics in such a way that the interaction between one and the graph changing, which is very common, are turned off.
Yeah, but okay, but you could do the same for the Hamiltonian if you first don't bother about anomalies of the Dirac algebra.
So let me ask the question, maybe it comes out of the context, but just ask it differently. Is it your cost of the limit for the number of the graph that you show? Is this clearly the definition of the
Yeah, so another way to say this, if I would generalize this to a graph which has much more edges than a cubic one, I would not be completely sure that the classical limit turns out correctly, and the reason for this, I guess, is that we don't know if we calculate the semi-classical limit of the volume operator. For low vertices, we know it turns out to be correct, but if we generalize it to much more edges, we are not sure whether it turns out to be the correct semi-classical limit. And since the volume operator enters in a crucial way here, I would not be completely sure if I generalized this to a large amount of edges at each vertex.